We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers, remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
You know, this is in many respects kind of a groundbreaking. see how good I am when I'm. It's a good thing this is not live.
Yeah.
In many respects, this is really a groundbreaking group. And this group actually got their start and their name after they received a standing ovation doing a well-known Jerry Lee Lewis hit. Now, if they had been doing a whole lot of shaking going on, they might have ended up calling themselves the Shakens. However, fortunately for the music world, they got a standing ovation doing a rousing rendition of Great Balls of Fire.
Yes.
Thus the name, the Fireballs. And ladies and gentlemen, one of the founding members, in fact, he's actually the founding member of the Fireballs. And coincidentally, his name is George Fireball. Is that correct? Or am I cheating a little bit? George, welcome to the show, and maybe you could tell me what this George Fireball is about. Is that just kind of a gag, and it's not your real name, right?
Yeah, it's just kind of like an identifier. You know, George Tomsco, of course, is my real name, T-O-M-S-C-O. George Fireball is just, you talk to people, and you give them your name.
Right.
They're in the music business, but if they're dealing with a lot of people, they don't remember which name goes with what group or
right.
whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started saying George Tomsco Fireballs. And I got to the point, I was just saying, George Fireball. So it's just a little nickname, you know.
Not only are we going to talk about your group, we're also going to bring in a very important member of your group who was not one of the original members, but was a very, very important member. And we're going to get to him in just a few moments from right now. You started the group in what year? Was it around 58 or so?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it was January of 58 when we learned one song, Great Balls of Fire, Jerry Lewis's song,
right.
For this talent show in Raton. It was the PTA, Parent Teacher Association talent show.
In Raton, New Mexico. Was it a small town?
Yeah, at that time it was about 9,000, and the main industry here was, at one time, mining and cattle. And since then, the mining industry has shut down, which I think is a shame, but we still have cows running around, you know?
Okay.
And thank goodness for the ranchers.
Yeah, but you didn't have any cows at that particular show that you performed in.
No, they wouldn't let the cows in that night.
The cows didn't come home for that show.
No, they didn't.
I don't believe you had a piano player in the group then, did you?
No, we didn't have a piano player. We had two guitars, bass and drums, and a lead singer.
Well, let's go through the lineup. You are George Tomsco, lead guitarist. Do you do some singing, too?
I didn't at the time. I do now. I'm really not a vocalist, but I guess I was just adequate at getting a song out, you might say. My forte is not vocally, but at that time, Chuck Tharp was our main vocalist. He didn't play guitar or anything. My main job in the first foundings of the Fireballs was to play lead guitar.
So you had yourself, you had Chuck Tharp, you had a gentleman by the name of Stan Lark who played the bass.
Yeah, Stan and I still work together.
Wow,
but, yeah.
After all these years. And the drummer was Eric Budd?
Eric Budd, yes.
And you had a rhythm guitarist by the name of Dan Trammell.
Yes.
So those were the Fireballs, a five-piece group with one single song in their repertoire, which was a darn good song, by the way. But
yeah.
You got this standing ovation, so what did you have to do, play it again?
Yeah, we did the song again, and then we wound up doing it the third time because
okay.
we didn't know any other song, you know? I mean, this was our first effort into getting a rock and roll song together.
Wow.
By five high school members.
Now, what was the group called before you were the Fireballs? Did you have a name that night?
We really didn't have a name. And after the show, I guess my uncle, my dad's brother, mentioned to him that we ought to be called the Fireballs. Then my dad relayed that to me, and I says, hey, that's a great name. You know, so it stuck immediately.
It's from that song?
Yeah, just from the song.
Great Balls of Fire. Now, how did you wind up in Norman Petty's studio, which was Clovis, New Mexico? Is that close to Raton?
250 miles away.
Oh, okay, so you had to go quite a ways. How did it happen that you got involved with Norm?
That was really, really strange because in high school, I really wanted to be in the music business, but I didn't know how to do it. I just didn't even know, where do you go from here? What do you do? You know. And so besides that, I kind of put that off to the side because in high school, I had gotten pretty good grades, and I won a scholarship down to New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology in Socorro. It was a scholarship for working a half a day and going to school a half a day. I think the tuition is paid. I had to buy the books and all of that. So my dad at the time said, son, we don't have the money to send you to college. You better take advantage of that. So I thought, well, okay. But, you know, actually, when I was graduated from high school, I was up to my nose in school. I wanted to do something. I wasn't interested in any more school. I wanted to see some progress. So because Dad had said, you better take advantage of this because it's on your plate right now, and you might as well use it. I just wasn't real happy about that, but I went ahead and went on down there, and I started in June, and gosh, I guess I was there maybe 30 days. But before we had left, the music director of the high school here in Raton, Pat Chavis, he ordered a disc cutting machine that would cut acetates. So whenever we would jam up here with the Fireballs, after that 58 concert, we started learning more rock and roll songs, and we played a few little jobs around town and stuff like that because we were the hot thing in town because we were the only rock and roll group.
Word got around, and were most of the songs you were playing, were they vocals or some instrumentals too?
Mainly vocals.
Okay.
Yeah, vocals at that time.
Which is really interesting because your initial hitting the charts was with instrumentals.
Yes, instrumentals.
Okay, so let's get us up to Norman Petty.
While I was down there in New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, I was playing one of these little discs that the music director had cut when we were rehearsing up the house. He would come up and practice using that machine on us while we were. So he gave us one of those. So I had that down there in the dorm and was playing that little acetate, and this guy stopped by. I had the door open in my room. After the record was over, he said, who's that? And I said, oh, that's our little group up there in Raton called the Fireballs, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he says, wow, man, that sounds really good. You guys ought to go down to Norm Petty's recording studio in Clovis, New Mexico, where I'm from, and record down there. He records Buddy Holly and the Crickets and Roy Orbison, and my mind just exploded. And I said, what? A recording studio in Clovis, New Mexico? Buddy Holly and the Crickets recording there?
But that was
Roy Orbison?
But that was about 250 miles away.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I said, you know, what's the guy's name? And he said, Norman Petty. And I said, wow. And so I wrote all this stuff down, and I went home the next weekend, and I told guys, I says, hey, there's a recording studio in Clovis.
Right.
Buddy Holly and the Crickets record down there. I said, I want to call them and see if we can go down and make a record or audition or something, you know.
Right.
So I got all excited, called Norman Petty on a Saturday, and I got a hold of Norma Jean Berry, who was the secretary, and told her, I said, we're in Raton, we got us a little rock and roll group, and we want to come down and make a record. And she said, just a minute. Then on the phone comes Norman Petty. He said, well, send me down a recording. Let's do that as a prerequisite.
Let's take it as one step at a time.
Yeah, one step at a time. And I stuttered for a little bit because we didn't have a tape recorder. And I told him in a couple of weeks we were going to be down there. Could we come by and audition?
Were you fibbing a little bit?
It was called an out-and-out lie.
Oh,
it was a lie. It was a bold-faced lie.
So you bluffed your way into a meeting with Norman Petty.
Yeah. And so he was very reluctant, but finally he said, well, when is it going to be? You know, and I said, well, in a couple of weeks. I had to scramble for a calendar.
Yeah.
And I said, such and such date. And I said, could we come by? I want you to hear us play.
Right.
So he said, well, okay.
You guys are so lucky because what if Norman Petty had said, hey, you know, I'll drop by the club where you're going to play?
You know, I was hoping he wouldn't say that. And the reason he didn't, because he was a churchgoer and he didn't go to clubs.
Oh, okay. But you were lucky. I mean, if he had called your bluff, my gosh, you would have to say, whoa, 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 whoa.
Whoa. Yes, exactly. So we got down there. We got in there about 1 o'clock to set up because we knew we had to be ready for him at 2. And there was a couple of guys in the control room, and Norma Jean let us in. We sat up, and we started rehearsing. Mm-hmm. Then 2 o'clock came, and there was no Norman. Then 3 o'clock came and there's no Norman.
No Norman.
And we kept playing all of these songs that we knew. We asked the secretary, Mr. Petty was supposed to be here at 2. When is he coming by? And she said, oh, that's Mr. Petty in the control room. I said, that's Norman Petty in the control room, because here's these two guys in there. They're both young-looking guys. They're both groomed very nicely.
And you had no idea? In other words, he was there all the time?
No, I had no idea that one of them was him.
You were auditioning for Norman Petty, and you didn't even know you were auditioning for Norman Petty.
They knew exactly what they were doing. They wanted to hear us without any pressure.
Well,
they wanted to hear us in the natural, so to speak.
Well, they sure did, and I assume that Norman liked what he heard.
Well, he did, and he come out, and he was kind of laughing, you know, and I just couldn't believe that he was Mr. Petty. I expected to see some fellow with a big belly and smoking a cigar, going to make you a star, son.
Going to make you a star, son.
And here this guy was a young man, very well-groomed, very soft-spoken, very pleasant. He said, well, do you have any original material? He says, what do you mean original material? He says, well, have you written any songs? Well, yeah, we got two of them we've written. And he said, did you play them? He says, yeah. He said, play them again. So we did. And then he said, well, who's your publisher? And we said, publisher?
Publisher? Huh? What?
What's that? He said, well, if you're going to record and if you write your own songs, you got to have a publisher. We just kind of looked at him like with, you know, a deer in the headlights, you know.
Yeah.
So he said, if you record, would you mind if I published your music? Here's Norman Petty asking if he could publish our music.
Well, that means he really liked it.
That would be wonderful.
So you basically made a deal with Norman, and you were using his studio and recording, and he was going to publish your stuff. Was he going to produce you as well?
Yeah, that was kind of the way. He didn't really consider himself a producer, but, you know, when you're doing a session, he would tell you all the things that were wrong.
So he was basically kind of an overseer, so to speak.
Exactly.
I see.
And so that's what happened. We were supposed to go home and then call him in a couple of weeks and stuff like that.
Right.
I didn't want to leave town. We were there on Sunday. Monday and Tuesday he was recording Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and I told him, well, we'll wait till Wednesday if you'll record.
Right. Yes.
And so he said, okay.
You did the session, I believe, on Wednesday night.
Did a Wednesday night session, right.
Was that Fireball?
Yes,
And I don't know.
And I don't know.
Now, what was the A side?
Actually, we thought that I Don't Know was going to be the A side.
But Billboard picked Fireball, as I'm thinking, in their review.
That's right.
And it came out on Cap Records.
Cap Records, yes.
And, in fact, you got quite a large bit of airplay and sales. So it's like a regional hit, basically. This is Fireball by the Fireballs.
Right.
And that came out in
January of 59.
January of 59.
Uh-huh.
Now, in September of 1959, you got your first top 40 hit, and it got to number 39 in the country, and this was called Torquay. Was this an original song?
Yes, uh-huh.
And again, you recorded this at Norman's studio with Norman overseeing it?
Right.
That was an instrumental. But actually, that was not the intended A side of the record.
That's correct. We actually intended the vocal, Crybaby, to be the A side.
It's Chuck Tharp doing the vocal on Crybaby?
Yes, he was. And we spent a lot of time in the studio recording that song, hours and hours and hours, and spent about 45 minutes on Torquay.
When did Chuck pass away?
Actually, 3 years ago on March 17th. He had not been well for quite a while, and it was a heart thing. And I was down in Austin playing down there with some friends and got the phone call.
This was the intended A-side, the one that you worked so hard on. This is Crybaby with Chuck Tharp doing the lead singing.
Believe tears, but when I'm gone, you'll cry all alone. Since you came into my life, all I've known are tears of strife. Cry, baby, here you go again.
Baby with Chuck Tharp doing the lead singing, but as it turned out, Torquay was the one that torqued off. It got to number 39 on the Billboard chart, and here is the very first official Fireballs hit single, a George Fireball composition. Torquay, and these are the Fireballs. great sound on that record, Torque. Great.
Well,
I love it.
Mr. Norman Pitt.
And the next record, Bulldog, got even higher on the chart than Torque, making it up to number 24. Again, was this an original composition?
Yes, it was. Remember, Ray Charles, What I Say? That little piano part there at the beginning, I always loved that intro. And I thought, boy, it'd be nice if I could come up with a melody that was the reverse of that.
Oh, I see.
So instead
kind of the antithesis.
Yeah, so I... It's sort of kind of like, but it's the reverse of that piano lick. That inspired me to write the instrumental of Bulldog.
Ronnie Allen and the Fireballs had two top 40 hits at that point, each of which had one word in the title, and each of which was written by George Tomskoe, a.k.a. George Fireball. And we're going to play one more top 40 hit that you guys had, which came out in 1961, Quite a Party. And again, I'm going to ask, did you write Quite a Party?
Yes, I wrote Quite a Party. By that time, we were regulars down at Norm Petty's studio.
I see, yes.
We were actually the studio band.
So you were doing sessions with other people, too?
Exactly. Besides our own stuff, you know, we moved down there. It was wonderful.
So, here you had the best of all these worlds. You're recording stars, you had national hits, also a studio band, doing what you love to do.
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, my head still just kind of floats around when I think about those days, because we had 10 years of working with Norman.
Here is the third instrumental hit by your group, the Fireballs. It's called Quite a Party, and I'm glad to play it right now.
Thank you.
quite a party, and the Fireballs. Now, I do have one question. You had all of these instrumental hits, but I think you mentioned that Chuck Tharp was not an instrumentalist. He was just a vocalist. Was he at these sessions with you?
Oh, absolutely. He was, yeah. And actually, what happened was our original guitar player, Danny Trammell, when we went on our first summer tour in 59 to the Midwest, he got sick. He had asthma real bad. And he got sick, wound up in the hospital. And Sonny James, remember Young Love?
Young Love, and he became a country superstar many years later. Not just Young Love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we were doing some dates with Sonny James and Tony Bellis.
Robin the Cradle. He had Robin the Cradle, that's right.
Yeah, and some others. And Danny got sick, was in the hospital. Sonny James bought Danny a ticket to come back to New Mexico because we didn't have the money, and he was sick, sick, sick. So he left his guitar with Chuck, and I started teaching Chuck how to play guitar.
So Chuck became one of the instrumentalists.
A vocalist and a guitarist.
Even though he wasn't on the hit records that we've played, he was on some of the other recordings that you did that were part of the Fireball albums.
Right, yes.
Did you have any concerns about being stereotyped as strictly an instrumental act?
Well, at the beginning, we were just elated the fact that we were getting any kind of play.
Okay.
I mean, I was. The fact that we were showing up on the charts was a big deal, and Chuck felt very distraught. It wasn't anything that we were doing. The disc jockeys were just...
They were gravitating toward the instrumentals.
Yeah, yeah. And we really did think, and we planned, that Crybaby was going to be the hit.
But it wasn't, as it
turned out. Chuck felt like he wasn't needed, which was not right at all.
Is this because of all the instrumental hits? Is that the problem?
Yeah, he just felt distraught, the fact that he really felt like he wasn't needed in the group, and that was not the case, because when we were out playing live performances,
we
did
a lot of
vocalists.
I'm sure you did a lot of vocals, but he may have felt that way, though, because the hit records were the instrumentals.
Exactly.
The bottom line is, even though you told him not to feel that way, he did decide to leave the group, and you needed a new vocalist.
Yeah. We had a meeting with Norman, and Norman said, I don't know if Jimmy Gilmer would be available. We heard his recording of Look Alive, which I thought was a great cut. Norman says, well, I'll call him and have him come over, and we'll just sit down and talk with him and see if he'd be interested.
Speaking of Jimmy, I believe that we have him on the line right now. Am I correct?
Yes, I am here.
Well, Jimmy, say hello to George.
Hello, George.
Yeah, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing great today.
You met with George, and what happened?
I don't really remember what day it was. I just remember I went over and pretty much spent the better part of the afternoon and evening discussing it. And I remember it kind of being settled. I think I said that I was interested right then, and we kind of talked it out, what it meant, what the schedule was. I was then informed that by accepting this position, you know, there was a tour that was coming up soon and that we needed to get started.
You had to learn a lot of songs pretty quickly, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Well, you know what? Because we were in a fix, we went in the musician's room and just kind of jammed a little bit together to see if some of the songs that we knew that he would do with us and some of the songs that he did that we could back him up on.
I see.
And it looked to me like it would really work really well. So Jimmy actually went back and came over on Tuesday and stayed.
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow.
I remember I went back and I remember getting home real early in the morning, like 2 or 3 in the morning. I had to drive back to Amarillo. And I remember going to my parents' house and waking them up and telling them, which was really hard, and I debated how to do it and everything, and I figured, well, I'll just tell them. And I pretty much told them that I wasn't going to be going back to school in the fall, that I had joined a rock and roll band, and I was hitting the road.
Okay, you hit the road, and we're going to kind of fast forward a little bit, because it was actually a couple of years later that the record that changed all of your lives came about. Jimmy, I'll let you tell me, because the billing on this particular record was Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. So please tell me the story of Sugar Shack.
Well, when I joined the Fireballs, I was kind of the front person and the singer. And at the same time, I had continued doing some solo recordings with the Fireballs and had put out a few records as Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. Nothing ever happened. We were primarily known as an instrumental group and kept pursuing that. But we tried to get material together and worked up for whenever there was a new tour that was coming up. And I remember we were getting ready to go start a new tour, and we were searching for new material, and Keith McCormick, who was a friend, he said he had a bunch of songs that he'd like for me to listen to. And I remember we sat down one day in the studios. It was in Clovis. He must have played me a dozen songs or something, and I picked out two or three that I thought were really pretty good, Sugar Shack being one of them, and I went ahead and learned them, and then got with George and Stan, and we worked them up and went out on the road and, like, road tested it, so to speak. And we just knew we had a hit based on the reaction that we got from that particular song, playing it to this audience.
That's the one that stood out.
It stood out.
What instrument is going boom, 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 boom?
It's an instrument called a solovox. And it's a electronic little instrument.
Is it actually a keyboard instrument? Basically?
Yes. Norman used it occasionally. He would attach it to his B3 organ. It had a little bracket, and it had a rheostat on it, which controlled the voltage to the keyboard. It was about an octave and a half.
Yeah,
keyboard instrument, about an octave and a half, little bitty thing that just attached to the organ, and by adjusting the voltage, you could tune it to whatever key you wanted it
in. I see. Well, that sure helped the record become a hit.
Well, we realized that a little later. We didn't like it at first, that's for sure.
You really didn't like it personally? You didn't care for it?
Oh, no.
Wow.
No, we were on the road. When we cut the master, so to speak, there was no solo box on it. And George just kind of played a guitar part in that situation. And we thought that it was finished. And I remember we got a copy of it out on the road. Norman advanced us a copy and sent it to us somewhere. And we sat down and listened to it, and I think we all just thought he ruined it.
What is that
goofy thing on there? That little tweet, tweet, tweet. You know, I was so disappointed
when I heard it. I was devastated. I said, Norman's ruined a really good record.
Yeah. We continued to feel that way. And, you know, it's interesting. We toured all over the country with it, and sometimes we'd get the people to whistle it or do something like that, but we never did add a solo box to our band or a keyboard instrument. George always just played it on the guitar.
Oh.
The riff, we didn't even
yeah.
know the lick. It was the first time we'd even heard that lick.
Very
and we
catchy.
Didn't really realize how important it was until we were in Detroit doing a television show. In the eyes of Dot, it was a regional record. Until finally this guy in Detroit started spinning it, and the phone calls just went crazy. And we went up there to do this TV show, and when we were doing the rehearsal, the run-through, they wanted to know where the flute player was.
When I heard it, I thought it was a flute.
A flute or a piccolo or something.
Piccolo, yeah, yeah.
Well, we ended up, I think, didn't we... George, I remember they had to have that on the record or they weren't going to do the show, and they hired a flute player who didn't appear with us. He was behind the curtains playing that lick.
Yes.
When we taped this show.
We're going to go back to 1963, and this was, in fact, not just a number one record 5 weeks in a row. It was the top record of the entire year of 1963. Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs with Sugar Shack.
Oh, there's a crazy little shack beyond the track, and everybody calls it the Sugar Shack. Well, it's just a coffee house, and it's made out of wood. Espresso coffee tastes mighty good. That's not the reason why I've gotta get back. You can understand why I've gotta get back up to that Sugar Shack. Whoa, baby, to that Sugar Shack. Yeah, honey, to that Sugar Shack. Oh, yes, to that Sugar Shack. And now that Sugar Shack.
lay down tracks in the direction of that sugar shack. Just me and her, yes, we're gonna go back to that sugar shack.
Sugar Shack, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. And George and Jimmy, I don't know if you're aware that the single also reached number one on Billboard's R&B chart for 1 week in November of 1963. Were you aware you were a number one R&B act?
Yeah, we. I don't remember when we found out, but I do remember knowing about that.
Something happened after your record was number one. Billboard decided to discontinue the chart. That you probably didn't know.
No,
they,
I didn't know
they
that.
Did. The single reached number one for 1 week, and its run on that chart was cut short because Billboard ceased publishing an R&B chart from November 30th, 1963 to January 23rd, 1965. We're going to move now to the follow-up. It had a kind of a similar sound to Sugar Shack.
That's true. Well, it was written by the same guy, Keith McCormick wrote it.
It had the same instrument in there.
Yeah, you know, back then, and it's been true for many, many years, you know, you had a hit and everybody wanted you to come with something that was just like it.
I know.
So that seemed to be the answer for that.
Yes.
This is almost exactly like it.
It got to number 15 on the chart, and it's kind of a fun song. It kind of ends with you speeding it up. It's a little bit different. She loves me, she loves me not. Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs and Daisy Petal Pickin. Daisy Petal Pickin. We have one more record which is billed as Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs, and that record is called, well, this one is a tough one, Jimmy. All I have it here is Ain't Gonna Tell Anybody, but I think that there have been some pressings that I have seen somewhere that said it's Ain't Gonna Tell Nobody. Am I just confused, or what's the deal with this one?
No, you're absolutely right, but don't ask me how that happened. It's obviously a mistake in some pressing of something. I probably have in my possession copies of both, but Ain't Gonna Tell Anybody is the way the lyric goes, and that's the way I prefer it to be.
I ain't gonna tell anybody that I've got a little girl like you. I ain't gonna tell anybody got a little girl to love me too. I'll tell no one, no one, that I've got a little girl like you to love me too. I ain't gonna tell anybody walk. I ain't gonna tell anybody about the cute little way you talk. I'll tell no one, no one, that I've got a little girl like you to love me too. Big, big secret, so hard to keep. I'd like to tell everyone, everyone I meet. But if I tell one, I've gotta tell two. I've gotta keep a secret if I wanna keep you. So ain't gonna tell anybody that I bought your wedding ring. I ain't gonna tell anybody. I ain't gonna tell no one a thing. I'll tell no one, no one, that I've got a little girl like you to love me too. Me too. I ain't gonna tell anybody. I ain't gonna tell anybody. I ain't gonna tell anybody.
All right, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs, and boy, this is kind of unusual because here you had all of those instrumental records, so you had a group that began with instrumentals. Now all of a sudden you have hit vocal records with Jimmy Gilmer, so you had the best of both worlds. And Jimmy, you play an instrument?
Yes, I played guitar. I was like second guitar.
I see.
The hardest thing for me was to learn all the instrumentals plus choreography that went with it.
Choreography, George.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
What kind
we
of choreography,
were,
George?
We were high stepping, man.
Yeah. Wait a minute. There is actually choreography, George. I didn't know this.
Oh, yeah. We had steps, man, for the instrumentals. We did, you know.
Ah.
Yeah.
I know that Chuck Berry had his duck walk. So is there a fireball walk or something? Or?
Well, George does a lot of that duck walking. But no, we actually had moves and movements and everything. And to me, the hardest challenge was to learn to do all those things and still play. It's not that easy.
We're going to skip now to the year 1967, where you had your next, what we'd call, really big success. Jimmy, you are doing the vocals on Bottle of Wine, right?
Correct.
But the billing now is not Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. Now it's just the Fireballs. So how did that come about?
Well, I think what was transpiring in the music at that particular time was that the groups were really coming on the scene, the names of groups. And we kind of had run our course, I guess, with Dot Records, because I remember when we cut Bottle of Wine, they still had the option for it.
Right.
They chose not to put it out, and we felt so strong about it that we wanted to. We just knew it tested well, so to speak, when we were out playing. We felt we had a bona fide hit, and we asked for a release, and Randy Wood was very gracious in letting us out of our contract, really. And Norman pursued another label,
Gold
ATCO,
right,
part of Atlantic. And I think the discussion was then that it was a group sound, because George and Stan are singing on it. It was just more of a group thing, and so the decision was made amongst us. Let's just go with the Fireballs.
The record kind of reminded me a little bit of the New Christy Minstrels record of Green Green, in the way that the vocals were very, very, like, kind of aggressive. Your vocal on this is kind of different from Sugar Shack. Sugar Shack is kind of more laid back, and this one is much more... You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah, I know it. It was harsh.
It was like a green, green.
We sing it harsh.
I remember Barry McGuire did the lead singing on Green Green, and it was green, green, it's green, they say, and this is Bottle of Wine, Fruit of the... So it's the same kind of feel to it. And we want to point out that this song was written by a great writer named Tom Paxton.
Correct.
Rough.
like that record. Great lyric, great performance. There's one other record I'm going to play before we play our closing record on the show, and this one is called Come On, React. Jimmy, can you react to my question here when I ask you what this one is about? It's about reacting, Ronnie. What do you think?
Well, it's about reacting.
Yeah. Ask a silly question, Ronnie. Get a silly answer.
For whatever reason, we had a series of records, that particular record, and I think probably the last record that we ever put out was a thing called Long Green. And it was a time when, for whatever reason, our popularity seemed to be west of the Mississippi. And we had great success with Come On React all up and down the West Coast, San Diego all the way to Seattle, top 10 in all those markets and everything. We weren't able to punch out the East Coast, but music was changing, and we were just trying to adapt and change with it. A lot of new groups were coming on the scene, and we were just trying to be competitive. That was kind of the result of it, and I felt it was a very good record. One thing that I have to say as I listen to all of these great recordings is that you're kind of like Heinz ketchup. You got so many different varieties. Boy, that was a conversation stopper, wasn't it? You don't know what to say. I mean, two people, deafening silence.
Well,
Jimmy's shaking his head. When you shake your head, Jimmy, you see people can't appreciate that on the radio. But actually, you know what my point is. I mean, you guys are just so versatile. You could do instrumentals. You could do a Sugar Shack, and then a totally different style on Bottle of Wine. You experimented with a lot of different things, and you hit the mark so many times, which is great.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we went through a 10-year period there, the 60s, which saw all kinds of new forms of music emerge.
Well, George and Jimmy, I want to thank the two of you for taking the time to celebrate your group, which had a wonderful history, so many different hit records, so many different musical styles. And what is your website?
www.fireballs-original.com. And it's for the Fireballs and Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. It's sort of like a double-barrel website.
Do you still perform today?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. The Fireballs continued on for several years, and Jimmy really was into management and all that, and then just finally recently we've gotten back together, and it's been great. We're ready to do a bunch of that.
I want to thank you, George, and I want to thank you, Jimmy.
Well, thank you, Ronnie, because I tell you what, it's guys like you that keep us alive.
Well, so we're trying.
We want to thank you.
very much. Ronnie, thank you for the opportunity, and like George says, it's really a lot of fun to be involved in these kind of discussions because it kind of stirs our memories a little bit ourselves.
We're going to close the show right now with something called Everybody Should Have Lived in the 50s. Around the early 1990s, you recorded this song.
In the 50s, I was a teenager. Gilmer was too, and it was a great time. And many, many years later, just thinking back about those times, I just had this little thought that, man, if you didn't live in the 50s, you just really missed a great time of life. And I just thought everybody should have lived in the 50s. And when I said that, I said, you know, that's a good song title.
Thanks.
So I started working on a song, and there it is.
That's the show. And now a couple of bonus tracks by the Fireballs. Both are rockabilly. The first one features Chuck Tharp doing the lead singing on Long, Long Ponytail.
Hey baby, why didn't you let me know? I've never seen you around here. finally, here's Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs with Red Cadillac and a Black Mustache.
Who've you been loving since I've been gone? A real tall man with a red coat on. Traveling baby, why can't you be true? Who've you been loving since I have been gone, gone, gone? Who've you been loving since I have been gone? Who's been running around with you? A real cool cat with eyes of blue. Good for nothing, baby, why can't you be true? Who's been running around with you? Yeah, you. Who's been running around with you? Somebody saw you at the break of day, a dining and a dancing at the cabaret. He was long and tall, plenty of cash. He had a red Cadillac and a black mustache. He held your hand and he sang you a song. Who've you been loving since I have been gone, gone, gone? Who've you been loving since I have been gone? Day, a dining and a dancing at the cabaret. He was long and tall, plenty of cash. He had a red Cadillac and a black mustache. He held your hand and he sang you a song. Who've you been loving since I have been gone, gone, gone? Who've you been loving since